Israel releases its report on the killing of 7 aid workers, and the world reacts.
But the essential problem is not who made the mistakes. It is the military strategy and procedures in place that allow for those mistakes to multiply time and time again.
Plus, water scarcity in a part of the world already plagued with conflict.
And in order to manage and share water properly, you need peace, stability, and trust. And we just don't have that in the region, so we are seeing tensions rising.
And later, NATO's support for Ukraine and Israel awaits an Iranian reaction. Today is Friday, April 5th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We're starting today with a developing story, another earthquake to tell you about, this time in New York City. At magnitude 4.7, it's much smaller than the one that rocked Taiwan earlier in the week. While shaking was felt, no serious damage or injuries were reported. The White House said that President Joe Biden was outraged after the deaths of 7 aid workers from World Central Kitchen in Gaza. This after an already deepening rift between Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu over the staggering amount of Palestinian civilian deaths in Israel's war against Hamas following the October 7th terror attack. It culminated in a phone call on Thursday between the two, as Biden is facing pressure from his political left as well as international allies to use the military aid the U.S. gives Israel as leverage to get the Israelis to make changes in how they're conducting the war. Reuters' Freddie Joyner has more.
President Joe Biden, for the first time since the start of the war in Gaza, threatened to condition support for Israel's offensive there, saying U.S. policy could change if Israel doesn't take concrete steps to protect civilians and aid workers. Biden's warning follows an Israeli airstrike that killed 7 aid workers and was relayed during a phone call on Thursday with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
We've gone from a hug to a handshake to a slap on the wrist today.
Laura Blumenfeld, a senior fellow at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, said it marks the first time Biden has sought to leverage U.S. aid to influence Israeli military behavior.
Look, this is tough. It's Biden on a tightrope with no net. He's caught in political crosswinds. From the left wing of his party, they're saying condition aid, you know, remove yourself from your all-out support for Israel. And then from the right, especially in Congress, the Republicans are threatening to blast him because they'll accuse him of weakness. I think the most important thing here is to set clear red lines. So if Biden can say, here are the lines, do not cross them, there will be consequences, that gives him credibility and leverage and leadership.
The White House had described Biden as outraged by the attack that killed World Central Kitchen aid workers.
Systematically, car by car.
The group's founder, celebrity chef Jose Andres, told Reuters in an interview Wednesday that the attack had targeted his aid workers deliberately.
Israel must meet this moment.
In Brussels, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the attack on aid workers this week must be the last, and that humanitarian aid must be surged into Gaza.
If we don't see the changes that we need to see, there'll be changes in our own policy.
At the White House, spokesperson John Kirby declined to elaborate on what specific changes the U.S. would make to its policy toward Israel and Gaza, but said the U.S. expected to see an announcement from Israel on steps it's taking to protect civilians and aid workers in the coming hours and days.
We want to see that even as the Israelis work through their investigation, that they are willing and able to take practical, immediate steps to protect aid workers on the ground and to demonstrate that they have that civilian harm mitigation in place.
Israel said on Thursday it would adjust tactics in the Gaza war after describing the attack as the result of a misidentification and that findings from an investigation would be made public soon.
That's Freddie Joyner of Reuters reporting for us today. For their part, Israel said it approved the reopening of the Eretz crossing into northern Gaza and the temporary use of Ashdod port in southern Israel to allow more aid to get into Gaza. This follows U.S. demands to increase the amount of humanitarian aid supplies getting through. Also, after an investigation into the airstrike that killed the workers from World Central Kitchen, the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces, released results of their internal investigation, saying in part, "The investigation's findings indicate the incident should not have occurred. Those who approved the strike were convinced they were targeting armed Hamas operatives and not World Central Kitchen employees. The strike on the aid vehicles is a grave mistake stemming from a serious failure caused by mistaken identification, errors in decision-making, and an attack contrary to the standard operating procedures." Additionally, a major and a colonel in the Israeli army have been dismissed, with brigade and division commanders receiving official reprimands. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken was at the airport in Brussels when he addressed reporters about the IDF report.
We received Israel's report on the terrible killing of the World Central Kitchen team in Gaza a few days ago. We're reviewing it very carefully. We'll be discussing its conclusions with Israeli officials and with humanitarian organizations in the days to come. It's very important that Israel is taking full responsibility for this incident. It's also important that it appears to be taking steps to hold those responsible accountable. Even more important is making sure that steps are taken going forward to ensure that something like this can never happen again.
In New York, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres reacted to the Israeli announcement.
"Following this week's appalling killing of seven humanitarian workers from World Central Kitchen, the Israeli government has acknowledged mistakes and announced some disciplinary measures. But the essential problem is not who made the mistakes. It is the military strategy and procedures in place that allow for those mistakes to multiply time and time again. Fixing those failures requires independent investigations and meaningful and measurable changes on the ground. In the aftermath of this tragedy, the United Nations was also informed by the Israeli government of its intention to allow a substantial increase in humanitarian aid distributed in Gaza. I sincerely hope that these announced intentions are effectively and quickly materialized, because the situation in Gaza is absolutely desperate."
Guterres also said the suffering is incomprehensible and entirely avoidable. Iran on Friday issued another warning that it will retaliate against Israel for what Tehran says was an Israeli strike that killed some of its top military commanders in Syria's capital 4 days ago. The commander-in-chief of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, Hossein Salameh, said our brave men will punish the Zionist regime, a reference to Israel, which has neither confirmed nor denied that it was behind the Damascus strike. My colleague Michael Lippin asked Jonathan Speier, Jerusalem-based research director of the Middle East Forum, about the significance of Iran toughening its verbal threats toward Israel in recent days.
First of all, I think we should remember that, you know, the killing of General Mohammad Reza Zahedi is a significant moment and a significant escalation, in the sense that this is certainly the most senior Quds Force operative killed pretty clearly by Israel, you know, since the beginning of the war. So it is a significant step up. There have, by the way, been Revolutionary Guards figures killed earlier in the war already, but this was the most senior one. So it's a significant moment. The Iranians have not responded in force, carrying out retaliation for those previous killings. They have now threatened to do so in the case of General Zahedi. My own sense is that there has to be something. There will be a response of some kind. It's almost certain. But that does not in any way make it inevitable, as some people have been predicting, that, okay, this means the Iranians will open the gate now to an open war between Iran and Israel. You know, there's a whole lot of steps they can take other than that. They can, for example, activate one or other of their proxies to take a direct action against Israel. That's to say, the Houthis or the militias in Iraq could launch a drone or missiles at Israel, as they have already done on numerous occasions in the course of the war.
Do you think the Iranian side believes they can somehow deter Israel from potentially carrying out more strikes like what Israel is suspected of having done on Monday?
It's possible that they do, but I think also they regard themselves as in a kind of state of undeclared war with Israel. But the thing is that the Iranians have been conducting this war with Israel for some time. And the pattern of it is they usually like to fight using Arab clients. They don't like to fight using Iranians. And that's why many people suspect that this retaliation, if and when it comes, will come from the Arab proxies. A cynical way of putting it would be to say that the Iranians are willing to fight to the last Arab. So, you know, it's quite possible that will remain to be the pattern of behavior. They're in, you know, this is not an isolated incident. This is part of a vast undeclared or declared on the Iranian side war, which has taken place between Israel and Islamic Republic of Iran throughout the region and to some degree beyond the region as well, in other parts of the world, in Europe, in Latin America and elsewhere.
So if Iran really is plotting some kind of retaliation through its proxies that it's been using for a while now in this conflict, what capabilities does Israel have to try to thwart an impending retaliation?
Well, both Israel and Israeli and Jewish facilities throughout the world are, of course, well defended because attempts to hit at them didn't start this week. So it means that obviously Israel has, you know, extensive air defenses over the skies of Israel in terms of Iron Dome, David Sling, and the Arrow systems, which are designed to deal with both, you know, short range and long range missiles and attempts at air attack. Jewish and Israeli facilities abroad obviously are defended by security structures which are in place for precisely a moment like this. So these are well-defended spaces because Israel and the Jewish world, you know, is aware that it is subject to an aggressive attempt at its destruction by Islamic Republic of Iran and its various allies.
That was VOA's Michael Lippin speaking with Jonathan Speier of the Middle East Forum in Jerusalem. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. An in-depth look at the NATO meeting in Brussels, and later a look at water scarcity in a region that's already plagued with conflict. But now to Ukraine. A massive drone attack was reported in Russia targeting a military airfield in the Rostov region. Meanwhile, Ukraine and its NATO allies are working on an urgent increase in Ukraine's air defense capabilities. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
Before dawn on Friday, a dozen drones attacked the Morozovsk military airfield in the Russian Rostov region. This was confirmed by Russian local news channels and the local governor, Vasil Golubev. Local residents reported more than 60 explosions and electricity cut off afterward. According to Golubev, air defense destroyed more than 40 drones. According to him, the power substation was damaged and the power supply is being restored. Ukrainian officials did not comment on the attack. However, the Ukrainian media, citing anonymous sources in the Ukrainian special services, reported that the attack was carried out by the Security Service of Ukraine together with the defense forces. According to preliminary data, at least 6 Russian battle jets were destroyed, 8 were significantly damaged. About 20 Russian soldiers were either killed or wounded. Meanwhile, in Brussels, the meeting of the ministers of foreign affairs of the NATO member countries came to an end. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said following the meetings at the NATO headquarters that the U.S. and its allies intend to double their efforts to find the resources that Ukraine needs. According to him, the approval of the aid package for Ukraine by the U.S. Congress is the most important and most urgent. In addition, the United States is discussing with NATO allies and partners what can be done to ensure that Ukraine has the resources it needs, both now and in the long term. Jens Stoltenberg, the Secretary General of NATO, said that the allies understand the urgency of the situation and are taking steps to make sure that Kyiv is well prepared.
Allies understand the urgency and therefore welcome also the announcements I just listed from several allies to provide more ammunition and more types of systems to Ukraine. They also understand the urgency of stepping up when it comes to air defense in particular. And therefore, allies will now go back and look into their inventories, look into if there are any ways they can provide more systems, in particular Patriots, but also, of course, ensure that the systems which are already there have the ammunition but also the spare parts, so they can all function as they should.
The Minister of Foreign Affairs of Ukraine, Dmytro Kuleba, said that Ukraine will conduct a dialogue with NATO partners regarding the supply of air defense systems, which could be delivered immediately. According to Kuleba, during the meeting of the Ukraine-NATO Council, he identified to the partners those systems which, according to his information, are available in NATO countries. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
And for a deeper look at the NATO meeting in Brussels, we check in with VOA's Henry Ridgewell.
NATO foreign ministers marked the 75th anniversary of the alliance's foundation Thursday, but the birthday celebrations were muted. Despite NATO support for Ukraine, Russia continues to make battlefield gains and continues to rain down missiles and drones on Ukraine's cities. Four people were killed and dozens injured in this attack on the eastern city of Kharkiv. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg gave a sobering assessment as the alliance meeting closed Thursday.
The situation on the battlefield remains serious. Ukraine needs more air defenses, more ammunition, and more aid. And therefore, allies will now go back and look into their inventories, look into if there are any ways they can provide more systems, in particular Patriots.
Ukraine's foreign minister, Dmytro Kuleba, appealed to NATO allies to give that aid and made a specific request for American-made Patriot air defense missiles.
Saving Ukrainian lives, saving Ukrainian economy, saving Ukrainian cities depends on the availability of Patriots and other air defense systems in Ukraine. And we're talking about Patriots because it's the only system that can intercept ballistic missiles. And only in March, Ukraine was hit with 94 ballistic missiles.
The US Congress is still blocking a military aid package for Ukraine worth around $60 billion. Speaking in Brussels Thursday, Secretary of State Antony Blinken urged lawmakers to vote for the bill.
We know what the needs are. Air defenses, artillery, munitions. So I believe, based on what I heard today, that everyone, including the United States, is going to double back and, as necessary, double down on finding the resources that Ukraine continues to need.
Ukraine's air defenses are not sufficient, says analyst Liana Fix of the Washington-based Council on Foreign Relations.
They only cover certain important strategic infrastructure for Ukraine and, of course, the capital of Ukraine, Kyiv. And we've seen that in recent weeks, Russia has stepped up its campaign, especially on Ukraine's energy infrastructure. And that is where Ukraine needs additional protection, where it needs those Patriots.
NATO's Secretary General has proposed a $107 billion five-year NATO fund to provide military support for Ukraine and hopes to reach agreement at July's annual NATO summit in Washington. But there was no concrete agreement at this week's meeting in Brussels. Again, Liana Fix.
Europeans both, I mean, in terms of financial support and military support, just can't make up for the huge amounts of military support that was coming from the United States.
Meanwhile, the Kremlin said Thursday that relations between NATO and Russia had, in its words, reached the level of direct confrontation. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
And finally today, water. We all need it to live, but in many places it's getting harder to find. The Middle East is one of those places. The region is already racked with war and conflict. The last thing they need is another crisis threatening the lives and livelihoods of its people. For a deeper understanding of the situation, I'm joined by Natasha Hall, a senior fellow with the Middle East program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
The Middle East is the most water-scarce region in the world, and what we're seeing today is that even countries that had relatively abundant resources when it came to water are also becoming much more water scarce. And this is part of a larger problem with water mismanagement, but also climate change. Temperatures in the Middle East and the sort of the Eastern Mediterranean are rising twice as fast as the rest of the world. Just to give you one example, the water level of the Dead Sea in Jordan has dropped the equivalent of a six-story building since the year 2000 alone. And the problem is likely to get far worse. Climate in countries from Egypt all the way to Saudi Arabia is projected to warm about another 9 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of the century. And that would lead to even more, at least 75% decrease in freshwater availability.
Now, is this happening because there are more people, there's more consumption of water, or is there drought? Is there less water coming in?
So it's both. It's primarily, I think, because of population growth and the need to sort of expand agriculture, irrigated agriculture as well, which has expanded exponentially in the past few decades in the Middle East. And this is the primary water user in places like Iraq and in Yemen, where agriculture takes up between 80 to 90% of the water resources. So it's partly that, and it's also partly climate change.
Now, certainly when you take a look at the Middle East, another existential crisis is not something that is needed there. How will this add to the conflict? Will there be conflict over water resources? How does this affect the politics of what's going on?
I would argue for decades there already has been a lot of conflict over water resources in the Middle East. The Pacific Institute has actually sort of carefully cataloged a lot of these instances. And by far, the most incidents are in the Middle East since really the dawn of human civilization. But I would argue it's obviously a bigger deal because we have, like I said, growing populations and much less water. And in order to manage and share water properly, you need peace, stability, and trust. And we just don't have that in the region. So we are seeing tensions rising. We're seeing people fighting over water. We're seeing people fighting and then not cooperating over water. And in the meantime, you have some weak states that are unable to basically defend themselves when others build large infrastructure like dams that will affect their water resources. So we are seeing actually tensions breaking out. Sometimes it's solely about water, but oftentimes it's sort of intertwined in the many different conflicts that are already occurring in the region today.
So what can be done? Does it need to be a political solution? Is there a technical solution? How can we get past this?
So what we found, unfortunately, is that it really does need to be political to a certain degree. There are a lot of countries in the region that are waiting for the perfect technical solution. A lot of them have turned to desalination, for example, desalinating seawater. But the problem with that is that you still don't get to the core of the issue, which is better water management, which also affects the quality of water that people drink and use in their daily lives. So there has to be some sort of governance angle of this. And hopefully technical solutions can also help. And there's other countries which are making strides. I would even say in Africa, which, you know, there's many countries that are fragile and conflict affected. They've done very well with river basin organizations that work together to monitor and share water resources. Even China has been very, very good at sort of making strides in groundwater management and groundwater quality monitoring. And so there's many different ways to deal with this, but each needs to be sort of context specific, especially in the Middle East, where you have so many other problems that are in the mix.
Natasha Hall with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Ms. Hall, thanks for your analysis. Thanks for talking about this problem with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next week, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.